Yes, hello. This is Adolf Hitler. Thinking of it made me laugh, and that brought me back to the present and the fellow behind me in the khaki shorts. Isn't it amazing how quickly one man can completely screw up a country, he said. You got that right, Mr. Mustache agreed. It's a goddamn mess is what it is. I assumed they were talking about George Bush, but gradually realized it was Barack Obama, who had at that point been in office for less than 6 months. The man with the mustache mentioned a GM dealership in his hometown. They were doing fine, but now the federal government's telling them they have to close. Like this is Russia or something, a communist country. The man in the khaki shorts joined in, and I wished I'd paid closer attention to the auto bailout stuff. It had been on the radio and in all the papers, but because I don't drive and I always thought that car dealerships were ugly, I'd either turn the page or let my mind wander, which was unfortunate, since I'd have loved to have turned around and given those two what for. Then again, even if I were informed, what's the likelihood of changing anyone's opinion, especially a couple of strangers? If my own little mind is nailed shut, why wouldn't theirs be? We've got to take our country back, the man with the mustache said. That's the long and short of it, and if votes won't do the trick, then maybe we need to use force. What struck me with him and with many of the conservatives I'd heard since the election was his overblown, almost egocentric take on political outrage, his certainty that no one else had quite experienced it before. What then had I felt during the Bush-Cheney years? Was that somehow secondary? Don't tell me I don't know how to hate, I wanted to say. Then I stopped and asked myself, do you really want that to be your message? Think you can out-hate me, asshole? I was fucking hating people before you were even born. We're forever blaming the airline industry for turning us into monsters. It's the fault of the ticket agents, the baggage handlers, the slowpokes at the newsstands and the fast food restaurants. But what if this is who we truly are, and the airport's just a forum that allows us to be our real selves, not just hateful, but gloriously so? Would Adolf Hitler please meet his party at baggage claim 4? Repeat, Adolf Hitler can meet his party at baggage claim 4. It's a depressing thought, and one that proved hard to shake. It was with me when I boarded my flight to Portland and was still on my mind several hours later when we were told to put our tray tables away and prepare for landing. Then the flight attendants, garbage bags in hand, glided down the aisle, looking each one of us square in the face and whispering without discrimination, "You're trash. You're trash. Your family's trash." Understanding Owls. Does there come a day in every man's life when he looks around and says to himself, I've got to weed out some of these owls? I can't be alone in this, can I? And of course, you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. Therefore, you keep the crocheted owl given to you by your second youngest sister and accidentally on purpose drop the mug that reads, Owl, love you always, and was sent by someone who clearly never knew you to begin with. I mean, mugs with words on them. Owl cocktail napkins stay because everyone needs napkins. Ditto owl candle. Owl trivet take to the charity shop along with the spool-sized Japanese owl that blinks his eyes and softly hoots when you plug him into your computer.
Just when you think you're making progress, you remember the owl tobacco tin and the owl tea cozy. Then there are the plates, the coasters, the Christmas ornaments. This is what happens when you tell people you like something. For my sister Amy, that thing was rabbits. When she was in her late 30s, she got one as a pet, and before it had chewed through its first phone cord, she'd been given rabbit slippers, cushions, bowls, refrigerator magnets, you name it. Really, she kept insisting, the live one is enough. But nothing could stem the tide of crap. Amy's invasion started with a live rabbit, while Hugh's and mine began, in the late 1990s, with decorative art. We were living in New York then, and he had his own painting business. One of his clients had bought a new apartment, and on the high domed ceiling of her entryway, she wanted a sky full of birds. Hugh began with warblers and meadowlarks. He sketched some cardinals and blue tits for color, and was just wondering if it wasn't too busy when she asked if he could add some owls. It made no sense nature-wise. Owls and songbirds work different shifts, but even if they didn't, they would still never be friends. No matter, though, this was her ceiling, and if she wanted turkey vultures, or, as was later decided, bats, that's what she would get. All Hugh needed was a reference. So we went to the Museum of Natural History and returned with Understanding Owls. The book came into our lives almost 15 years ago, and I've yet to go more than a month without mentioning it. You know, I'll say there's something about nocturnal birds of prey that I just don't get. If only there was somewhere I could turn for answers. I wish I could help you, you will say, adding a second or two later, hold on a minute. What about understanding owls? We've performed this little routine more times than I can count, but back then, when the book was still fresh-smelling and its pages had not yet yellowed, I decided that because Hugh actually did get a kick out of owls, I would try to find him a stuffed one. My search turned up plenty of ravens. I found pheasants and ducks and foot-tall baby ostriches. I found a freeze-dried turkey's head attached to its own foot, but owls, no luck. That's when I learned that it's illegal to own them in the United States, even if one dies naturally of a stroke or old age. If it chokes on a mouse or gets kicked by a horse. Should one fly against your house, break its neck, and land like magic on your front stoop, you're still not allowed to stuff it or even to store its body in the freezer. Technically, you're not even allowed to keep one of its feathers. That's how protected they are. I learned this at a now-defunct taxidermy shop in Midtown Manhattan. But if you're really interested, the clerk I spoke to said, I've got a little something you might want to see. He stepped into the back room and returned with what I could only identify as a creature. What we've done, he boasted, is stretch a chicken over an owl form. That's really something, I said, groping for a compliment. The truth was that even a child would have seen this for what it was, the beak made from what looked to be a bear claw, the feet with their worn-down pedestrian talons. I mean, please, this was what a chicken might wear to a Halloween party if she had 10 minutes to throw a costume together. Let me think about it, I said. Years later, we moved to Paris, where within my first week, I found an albino peacock. I found swans and storks and all manner of seabirds, but again, no owls, because stuffing them is forbidden in France. In the UK, though, it's a slightly different story. You can't go out and shoot one, certainly. They're protected in life just as they are in the US, but afterward, in death, things loosen up a bit. Most of the owls I saw in Great Britain had been stuffed during the Victorian era. I'd see them at English flea markets and in Scottish antique shops. But as is always the case, the moment you decide to buy one, they're nowhere to be had. I needed one, or decided I did, in February 2008. Hugh and I were moving from our apartment to a house in Kensington. And after going through our owl objects and deciding we could do without 9/10 of them, I thought I'd get him the real thing for Valentine's Day. Should have started looking a month or two in advance, but with Christmas and packing and helping to ready our new place, it had slipped my mind. Thus, I wound up on February 13th, calling a London taxidermy shop and asking if they had any owls. The person who answered the phone told me that he had two of them, both recent specimens and freestanding, not behind glass as most of the old ones are. The store was open only by appointment, and after arranging to come by the following afternoon, I went to where Hugh was packing books in the next room and said, "I am giving you the best Valentine's Day gift ever." This is one of those things I do and immediately hate myself for. How is the other person supposed to respond? What's the point? For the first 16 years we were together, I'd give Hugh chocolates for Valentine's Day, and he'd give me a carton of cigarettes. Both of us got exactly what we wanted, and it couldn't have been easier. Then I quit smoking. I decided that in place of cigarettes, I needed, say, an 18th century scientific model of the human throat. It was life-size, about 4 inches long, and because it was old, handmade, and designed to be taken apart for study, it cost quite a bit of money. "When did Valentine's Day turn into this?" Hugh asked, when I told him he had to buy it for me. What could I say? Like everything else, holiday gifts escalate. The presents get better and better until one year you decide you don't need anything else and start making donations to animal shelters. Even if you hate cats and dogs, you're somehow always the ones who benefit. "Eventually, we'll celebrate by spaying a few dozen kittens," I said, "but until that day comes, I want that throat." On Valentine's Day, I carried a few boxes from our apartment to the house we'd bought. It looked like the sort of place where Scrooge might have lived, a narrow brick building, miserly in terms of space, and joined to identical, equally grim houses on either side of it. From there, I walked around the corner and got on the underground. The taxidermy shop was on a quiet street in North London, and as I approached, I saw a man and his two sons with their faces pressed against the barred front windows. "A polar bear," one of the boys shouted. The other tugged on his father's coat. "And a penguin, look at the baby penguin." My heart raced. The man who owned the shop was so much taller than me that in order to look him in the eye, I had to throw my head all the way back, like I do at the dentist's office. He had enviably thick hair, and as he opened the door to let me in, I noticed an orange kitten positioned on the floor beside a Dalmatian puppy. Casting a shadow upon them was a rabbit standing upright on its hind legs, and above him, on a shelf, sat two tawny owls, each mounted to a stump and standing around 20 inches high. Both were females and in great shape, but what I'd really wanted was a barn owl. Those other ones with spooky white faces, like satellite dishes with eyes. "We do get those from time to time, but they're rare," the taxidermist said. Above his head hung a massive seagull with its beak open, and next to him, on a tabletop, lounged a pair of hedgehogs. I've seen better variety, but there was no denying that the man did beautiful work. Nothing had crooked eyes or bits of exposed plaster at the corners of its mouth. If seen in a photo, you'd think that these animals were alive and had gathered peacefully to boast about their excellent health. The taxidermist and I discussed the owls, and when my eyes cut to a glass-doored cabinet with several weather-beaten skulls inside it, he asked if I was a doctor. Me? For some reason, I looked at my hands. Oh, goodness, no. Then your interest in those skulls is non-professional? Exactly. The taxidermist's eyes brightened, and he led me to a human skeleton, half hidden in the back of the room. "Who do you think this was?" he asked. Being a layman, all I had to go by was a height, between 4.5 and 5 feet tall. "Is it an adolescent?" The taxidermist invited me to guess again, but before I could, he blurted, "It's a pygmy." He then told me that in the 19th century, the English went to what is now the Congo and hunted these people, tracked them down and shot them for sport. Funny how quickly this changed the mood. "But he could have died of a heart attack, right?" I said. "I mean, how are we to know for certain that he was murdered?" "Oh, we know all right," the taxidermist told me. It would have been disturbing to see the skeleton of a slain pygmy in a museum, but finding him in a shop, for sale, raised certain questions. Uncomfortable ones like, how much is he? "If you like the odd bits and pieces, I think I've got something else you might enjoy." The taxidermist retreated to the area behind his desk and pulled a plastic bag off an overhead shelf. It was, I noticed, from Waitrose, a grocery store, described to me upon my move to England as a cut above. From the bag, he removed what looked like a platter with an oblong glass dome over it. Inside was a man's forearm, complete with little hairs and a smudged tattoo. The taxidermist said, completely unnecessarily, "Now there's a story behind this. For what human limb in a Waitrose bag is not without some sort of story?" He placed a platter on the table, and as the lid was lifted and set to the side, I was told that 100 years ago, the taxidermist's grandfather witnessed a bar fight between two sailors. One was armed with a saber, and the other, apparently, was disarmed with one. After it happened, the crowd went wild. The amputee fell on his back, and as he lay there in shock, bleeding to death, the taxidermist's grandfather looked down at the floor, at the blood-soaked fingers that may have still been twitching, and likely thought, "Well, it's not like it's doing him any good." The story sounds a bit far-fetched, but there was no denying that the arm was real. The cut had been made 2 inches south of the elbow, and the exposed end with its cleanly severed radius and ulna reminded me of Osso Buco. "It was my grandfather who mummified it," the taxidermist said. "You can see that it's not the best job in the world, but it's really rather good for a first attempt." I leaned closer. "Touch it," he whispered. And as if I were under a spell, I did, shuddering a little at the feel of the hairs. Equally creepy was the arm's color, which was not Caucasian flesh tone, but not brown either, the way most desiccated body parts are. This was the same slightly toasted shade as a spray-on tan. "I think I'll just take one of those owls," I said. "The one on the left, if that's okay." The taxidermist nodded. Then he reached to an even higher shelf and brought down another plastic grocery bag, this one from Tesco, which is decidedly less upscale. "Now a smell is going to hit you when I open this up, but don't worry," he said. "It's just the smoke they use to preserve the head." That's a phrase you don't hear too often, so it took a moment for it to sink in. When he opened the bag, I saw that he might more accurately have said the head of this teenage girl, for she'd been no older than 14 at the time of her death. This sounds super grisly, but is, I propose, just medium grisly. The head was 400 years old and came from somewhere in South America, Peru, I think he said. The skin was dry and thin, like leather on an old worn-out purse. Parts of it were eaten away, exposing the skull beneath it. But what really struck me was her hair, which was sleek and black, divvied into delicate, slender braids. I didn't ask the price, but said a little more emphatically, "I really think the owl will do it for me today. It's a Valentine's Day present, perfect for our new place. A house, actually, no basement, and 3 stories tall." I wasn't trying to be boastful. I just wanted him to know that I was loved and that I lived above ground. A few minutes later, the owl secured in a good-sized cardboard box, I headed back to the underground. Ordinarily, I'd be elated. I'd been determined to find Hugh the perfect present, and by golly, I had done it. But instead, I felt unhinged, not by the things I had seen so much as by the taxidermist. It's common to be misread by people who don't know you. "Like to try Belligerent, the new fragrance for men?" I'll be asked in a department store. And I always think, really, do I seem like the kind of guy who would wear cologne? Hotel operators so often address me as Mrs. Sedaris that I no longer bother to correct them. I've been mistaken for a parent, a pickpocket, and even, God forbid, an SUV owner, and I've always been able to brush it off. What's rare is not to be misread. The taxidermist knew me for less time than it took to wipe my feet on his mat, and with no effort whatsoever, he looked into my soul and recognized me for the person I really am, the type who'd actually love a pygmy, and could easily get over the fact that he'd been murdered for sport, thinking breezily, "Well, it was a long time ago." Worse still, I would flaunt it, hoping in the way a Porsche owner does that this would become a part of my identity. "They say he has a pygmy," I could imagine my new neighbors whispering as I walked down the street. "Hangs him plain as day in the corner of his room, next to the musket he was shot with." I'd love to be talked about this way, but how did the taxidermist know? Plenty of people must go into his store, ask for a kitten or a seagull or whatever, and walk out 5 minutes later knowing nothing about the human parts. Why show me the head in the grocery bag? As for the arm, how had he known I'd been dying to touch it? I hadn't said anything one way or the other. So what was the giveaway? At the station, I went through the turnstile and stood on the platform until a train arrived. The owl wasn't heavy, in fact, it was surprisingly light, but the box was cumbersome, so I was happy to find a seat. At our first stop, a teenage girl in a school uniform got on and took the spot across from me. Deal with a kid her age today and the thought of her head winding up behind some shop counter in a plastic bag might not be all that troubling. I mean, the mouths on some of them. That said, it shouldn't just be any girl her age. The one the taxidermist showed me, for instance, what was her story? 14-year-olds existed 400 years ago, but teenagers, with their angst and rebelliousness, their rage and Ritalin and very own version of Vogue magazine, are a fairly recent construct. In the 17th century jungles of Peru, a kid that age would have babies already. Half her life would probably be over, and that's if she was lucky. To have your chopped-off head preserved and then wind up in a Tesco bag some 6,000 miles away, that was the indignity. Tesco. At least the arm was in a Waitrose bag. It bothered me that the bag bothered me more than the head did, but what are you going to do? A person doesn't consciously choose what he focuses on. Those things choose you. And once they do, nothing, it seems, can shake them. Find someone with a similar eye, and Christmas shopping is a breeze. I can always spot something from my sisters Gretchen and Amy. The three of us can walk into a crowded party and all zoom in on the person who's missing a finger or who has one regular-sized ear and one significantly smaller one, while my sister Lisa will pick up on something else entirely. Hugh and I don't notice the same things either. That's how he can be with me. Everything the taxidermist saw is invisible to him. My superficiality. My juvenile fascination with the abnormal, my willingness to accept and sometimes even celebrate evil. Point this out and he'll say, David? My David? Oh, no, he's not like that at all. A person who's that out of it deserves both an owl and chocolate. So I got off the train at Piccadilly Circus and picked him up a box. Then I caught a bus and hurried toward home, thinking about love and death and about that throat. So elegant in its detail, which was, no doubt, awaiting me. Now we are five. In late May 2013, a few weeks shy of her 50th birthday, my youngest sister, Tiffany, committed suicide. She was living in a room in a beat-up house on the hard end of Somerville, Massachusetts, and had been dead, the coroner guessed, for at least 5 days before her door was battered down. I was given the news over a white courtesy phone while at the Dallas airport. Then, because my plane to Baton Rouge was boarding and I wasn't sure what else to do, I got on it. The following morning, I boarded another plane, this one to Atlanta, and the day after that, I flew to Nashville, thinking all the while about my ever-shrinking family. A person expects his parents to die, but a sibling? I felt I'd lost the identity I'd enjoyed since 1968 when my brother was born. Six kids, people would say. How do your poor folks manage? There were a lot of big families in the neighborhood I grew up in. Every other house was a fiefdom, so I never gave it much thought until I became an adult and my friends started having children. One or two seemed reasonable, but anything beyond that struck me as outrageous. A couple Hugh and I knew in Normandy would occasionally come to dinner with their wrecking crew of three, and when they'd leave several hours later, every last part of me would feel violated. Take those kids, double them, and subtract the cable TV. That's what my parents had to deal with. Now, though, there weren't six, only five. And you can't really say there used to be six, I told my sister Lisa. It just makes people uncomfortable. I recalled a father and son I'd met in California a few years back. So are there other children? I asked. There are, the man said.
three who were living, and a daughter, Chloe, who died before she was born 18 years ago. That's not fair, I remember thinking, because, I mean, what's a person supposed to do with that? Compared to most 49-year-olds, or even most 49-month-olds, Tiffany didn't have much. She did leave a will, though. In it, she decreed that we, her family, could not have her body or attend her memorial service. "So put that in your pipe and smoke it," our mother would have said. A few days after getting the news, my sister Amy drove to Somerville with a friend and collected two boxes of things from Tiffany's room, family photos, many of which had been ripped into pieces, comment cards from a neighborhood grocery store, notebooks, receipts. The bed, a mattress on the floor, had been taken away, and a large industrial fan had been set up. Amy snapped some pictures while she was there, and individually and in groups, those of us left studied them for clues. A paper plate on a dresser that had several drawers missing, a phone number written on a wall, a collection of mop handles, each one a different color, arranged like cattails in a barrel painted green. 6 months before our sister killed herself, I had made plans for us all to gather at a beach house on Emerald Isle, off the coast of North Carolina. My family used to vacation there every summer, but after my mother died, we stopped going, not because we lost interest, but because it was she who always made the arrangements and, more important, paid for it. The place I found with the help of my sister-in-law, Kathy, had 6 bedrooms and a small swimming pool. Our week-long rental period began on Saturday, June 8th. And we arrived to find that a livery woman standing in the driveway with 7 pounds of seafood, a sympathy gift sent by friends. "They slawn there, too," she said, handing over the bags. In the past, when my family rented a cottage, my sisters and I would crowd the door like puppies around a food dish. Our father would unlock it, and we'd tear through the house claiming rooms. I always picked the biggest one facing the ocean, and just as I'd start to unpack, my parents would enter and tell me that this was theirs. "I mean, just who the hell do you think you are?" my father would ask. He and my mother would move in, and I would get booted to what was called the maid's room. It was always on the ground level, a kind of dank shed next to where the car was parked. There was never an interior stairway leading to the upper floor. Instead, I had to take the outside steps and, more often than not, knock on the locked front door like a beggar, hoping to be invited in. "What do you want?" my sisters would ask. "I want to come inside." "That's funny," Lisa, the eldest, would say to the others who were gathered like disciples around her. "Did you hear something? A whining sound? What is it that makes a noise like that? A hermit crab? A little sea slug?" Normally, there was a social divide between the 3 oldest and the 3 youngest children in my family. Lisa, Gretchen, and I treated the others like servants and did very well for ourselves. At the beach, though, all bets were off, and it was just upstairs against downstairs, meaning everyone against me. This time, because I was paying, I got to choose the best room. Amy moved in next door, and my brother Paul, his wife, and their 10-year-old daughter, Maddie, took the spot next to her. That was it for Oceanfront. The others arrived later and had to take the leftovers. Lisa's room faced the street, as did my father's. Gretchen's room faced the street and was intended for someone who was paralyzed. Hanging from the ceiling were electric pulleys designed to lift a harnessed body into and out of bed. Unlike the cottages of our youth, this one did not have a maid's room. It was too new and fancy for that, as were the homes that surrounded it. Traditionally, the island houses were on stilts, but more and more often now, the ground floors are filled in. They all have beachy names and are painted beachy colors, but most of those built after Hurricane Fran hit the coast in 1996 are 3 stories tall and look almost suburban. This place was vast and airy. The kitchen table sat 12, and there was not one, but 2 dishwashers. The pictures were ocean-related, seascapes and lighthouses, all with the airborne Vs that are shorthand for seagull. A sampler on the living room wall read, "Old Shellers never die. They simply conk out." On the round clock beside it, the numbers lay in an indecipherable heap, as if they'd come unglued. Just above them were printed the words, "Who cares?" This was what we found ourselves saying whenever anyone asked the time. Who cares? The day before we arrived at the beach, Tiffany's obituary ran in the Raleigh News and Observer. It was submitted by Gretchen, who stated that our sister had passed away peacefully at her home. This made it sound as if she were very old and had a house. But what else could you do? People were leaving responses on the paper's website, and one fellow wrote that Tiffany used to come into the video store where he worked in Somerville. When his glasses broke, she offered him a pair she had found while foraging for art supplies in somebody's trash can. He said she also gave him a Playboy magazine from the 1960s that included a photo spread titled "The Ass Menagerie." This was fascinating, as we really didn't know our sister very well. All of us had pulled away from the family at some point in our lives. We'd had to in order to forge our own identities, to go from being a Sedaris to our own specific Sedaris. Tiffany, though, stayed away. She might promise to come home for Christmas, but at the last minute there'd always be some excuse. She missed her plane, she had to work. The same would happen with our summer vacations. The rest of us managed to make it, I'd say, aware of how old and guilt-trippy I sounded. We'd all be disappointed by her absence, though for different reasons. Even if you weren't getting along with Tiffany at the time, you couldn't deny the show she put on, the dramatic entrances, the nonstop professional-grade insults, the chaos she'd inevitably leave in her wake. One day she'd throw a dish at you, and the next she'd create a mosaic made of the shards. When allegiances with one brother or sister flamed out, she'd take up with someone else. At no time did she get along with everybody, but there was always someone she was in contact with. Toward the end, it was Lisa, but before that, we'd all had our turn. The last time she joined us on Emerald Isle was in 1986, and even then she left after 3 days, Gretchen reminded us. As kids, we spent our beach time swimming. Then we became teenagers and devoted ourselves to tanning. There's a certain kind of talk that takes place when you're lying, dazed in the sun, and I've always been partial to it. On the first afternoon of our most recent trip, we laid out on one of the bedspreads we'd had as children and arranged ourselves side by side on it, trading stories about Tiffany. What about the Halloween she spent on that army base? And the time she showed up at Dad's birthday party with a black eye? I remember this girl she met years ago at a party, I began when my turn came. She'd been talking about facial scars and how terrible it would be to have one. So Tiffany said, "I have a little scar on my face, and I don't think it's so awful." "Well," the girl said, "you would if you were pretty." Amy laughed and rolled over onto her stomach. "Oh, that's a good line." I rearranged the towel I was using as a pillow. "Isn't it, though?" Coming from someone else, a story might have been upsetting, but not being pretty was never one of Tiffany's problems, especially when she was in her 20s and 30s and men tumbled helpless before her. "Funny," I said, "but I don't remember a scar on her face." I stayed in the sun too long that day and got a burn on my forehead. That was basically it for me in the beach blanket. I made brief appearances for the rest of the week, stopping to dry off after a swim, but mainly I spent my days on a bike, cycling up and down the coast and thinking about what had happened. While the rest of us seemed to get along effortlessly, with Tiffany, it always felt like work. She and I usually made up after arguing, but our last fight took it out of me, and at the time of her death, we hadn't spoken in 8 years. During that period, I regularly found myself near Somerville, and though I'd always toy with the idea of contacting her, I never did, despite my father's encouragement. Meanwhile, I'd get reports from him and Lisa. Tiffany had lost her apartment, had gone on disability, had moved into a room found for her by a social service agency. Perhaps she was more forthcoming with her friends, but her family got things only in bits and pieces. She didn't talk with us so much as at us, great blocks of speech that were by turns funny, astute, and so contradictory it was hard to connect the sentence you were hearing with the one that preceded it. Before we stopped speaking, I could always tell when she was on the phone. I'd walk into the house and hear Hugh say, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. In addition to the two boxes that Amy had filled in Somerville, she also brought down our sister's 1978 ninth grade yearbook. Among the messages inscribed by her classmates was the following, written by someone who had drawn a marijuana leaf beside her name. Tiffany, you are a one-of-a-kind girl, so stay that way, you unique ass. I'm only sorry we couldn't have partied more together. This school sucks to hell. Stay cool, stoned, drunk, fucked up. Check your ass later. Then there's Tiffany. I'm looking forward to getting high with you this summer. And Tiffany, call me sometime this summer and we'll go out and get blitzed. A few weeks after these messages were written, Tiffany ran away and was subsequently sent to a disciplinary institution in Maine called Elon. According to what she told us later, it was a horrible place. She returned home in 1980, having spent 2 years there, and from that point on, none of us can recall a conversation in which she did not mention it. She blamed the family for sending her off, but we, her siblings, had nothing to do with it. Paul, for instance, was 10 when she left. I was 21. For a year, I sent her monthly letters. Then she wrote and told me to stop. As for my parents, there were only so many times they could apologize. We had other kids, they said in their defense. You think we could let the world stop on account of any one of you? We were at the beach for 3 days before Lisa and our father, who is now 90, joined us. Being on the island meant missing the spinning classes he takes in Raleigh. So I found a fitness center not far from the rental cottage, and every afternoon he and I would spend some time there. On the way over, we'd talk to each other, but as soon as we mounted our stationary bikes, we'd each retreat into our own thoughts. It was a small place, not very lively. A mute television oversaw the room, tuned to the weather channel, and reminding us that there's always a catastrophe somewhere or other, always someone flooded from his home or running for his life from a funnel-shaped cloud. Toward the end of the week, I came upon my father in Amy's room, sifting through the photos that Tiffany had destroyed. In his hand was a fragment of my mother's head with a patch of blue sky behind her. Under what circumstances had this been ripped up, I wondered. It seemed like such a melodramatic gesture, like throwing a glass against a wall, something someone in a movie would do. Just awful, my father whispered. A person's life reduced to one lousy box. I put my hand on his shoulder. Actually, there are two of them, he corrected himself. Two lousy boxes. One afternoon on Emerald Isle, we all rode to the Food Lion for groceries. I was in the produce department, looking at red onions, when my brother sneaked up from behind and let loose with a loud achoo, this while whipping a bouquet of wet parsley through the air. I felt the spray on the back of my neck and froze, thinking a very sick stranger had just sneezed on me. It's a neat trick, but he also doused the Indian woman, who was standing to my left. She was wearing a blood-colored sari, so got it on her bare arm as well as her neck and the lower part of her back. "Sorry, man," Paul said when she turned around, horrified. "I was just playing a joke on my brother." The woman had many thin bracelets on, and they jangled as she brushed her hand against the back of her head. "You called her man," I said to him after she walked off. "For real?" he asked. Amy mimicked him perfectly. "For real?" Over the phone, my brother, like me, is often mistaken for a woman. As we continued shopping, he told me that his van had recently broken down, and that when he called for a tow truck, the dispatcher said, "We'll be right out, sweetie." He lowered a watermelon into the cart and turned to his daughter. "Maddie's got a daddy who talks like a lady, but she don't care, does she?" Giggling, she punched him in the stomach, and I was struck by how comfortable the two of them are with each other. Our father was a figure of authority, while Paul is more of a playmate. When we went to the beach as children, on or about the fourth day, our father would say, "Wouldn't it be nice to buy a cottage down here?" We'd get our hopes up, and then he would bring practical concerns into it. They weren't petty. Buying a house that will eventually get blown away by a hurricane probably isn't the best way to spend your money. But still, we wanted one desperately. I told myself when I was young that one day I would buy a beach house, and that it would be everyone's, as long as they followed my draconian rules and never stopped thanking me for it. Thus it was that on Wednesday morning, midway through our vacation, Hugh and I contacted a real estate agent named Phyllis, who took us around to look at available properties. On Friday afternoon, we made an offer on an oceanfront cottage not far from the one we were renting, and before sunset, our bid was accepted. I made the announcement at the dinner table and got the reaction I had expected. "Now wait a minute," my father said. "You need to think clearly here." "I already have," I told him. "Okay, then, how old is the roof? How many times has it been replaced in the last 10 years? When can we move in?" Gretchen asked. Lisa wanted to know if she could bring her dogs, and Amy asked what the house was named. "Right now, it's called Fantastic Place," I told her, "but we're going to change it. I used to think the ideal name for a beach house was the Ship Shape. Now, though, I had a better idea. We're going to call it the C-section." My father put down his hamburger. "Oh, no, you're not." "But it's perfect," I argued. "The name's supposed to be beachy, and if it's a pun, all the better." I brought up a cottage we'd seen earlier in the day called Dune Our Thing, and my father winced. "How about naming it Tiffany?" he said. Our silence translated to, "Let's pretend we didn't hear that." He picked his hamburger back up. "I think it's a great idea. The perfect way to pay our respects." "If that's the case, we can name it after Mom," I told him. "Or half after Tiffany and half after Mom. But it's a house, not a tombstone. It wouldn't fit in with the names of the other houses." "Aw, baloney," my father said. "Fitting in. That's not who we are. That's not what we're about." Paul interrupted to nominate the conch sucker. Amy's suggestion had the word semen in it. And Gretchen's was even dirtier. "What's wrong with the name it already has?" Lisa asked. "No, no, no," my father said, forgetting, I think, that this wasn't his decision. A few days later, after the buyer's remorse had kicked in, I'd wonder if I hadn't bought the house as a way of saying, "See, it's just that easy. No hemming and hawing, no asking to look at the septic tank. Rather, you make your family happy and iron out the details later." The cottage we bought is 2 stories tall and was built in 1978. It's on proper stilts and has 2 rear decks, one above the other, overlooking the ocean. It was rented to vacationers until late September, but Phyllis allowed us to drop by and show it to the family the following morning after we checked out of the house we'd been staying in. A place always looks different, worse, most often, after you've made the commitment to buy it. So while the others raced up and down the stairs, claiming their future bedrooms, I held my nose to a vent and caught a whiff of mildew. The sale included the furniture, so I also made an inventory of the Barca loungers and massive TVs I would eventually be getting rid of, along with the shelled pattern bedspreads and cushions with anchors on them. "For our beach house, I want to have a train theme," I announced. "Trains on the curtains, trains on the towels. We're going to go all out." "Oh, brother," my father moaned. We sketched out a plan to return for Thanksgiving, and after saying goodbye to one another, my family splintered into groups and headed off to our respective homes. There'd been a breeze at the beach, but once we left the island, the air grew still. As the heat intensified, so did the general feeling of depression. Throughout the 60s and 70s, the road back to Raleigh took us past Smithfield and a billboard on the outskirts of town that read, "Welcome to Klan Country." This time we took a different route, one my brother recommended. Hugh drove, and my father sat beside him. I slumped down in the back seat next to Amy, and every time I raised my head, I'd see the same soybean field or low-slung cinder-block building we'd seemingly passed 20 minutes earlier. We'd been on the road for a little more than an hour when we stopped at a farmer's market. Inside an open-air pavilion, a woman offered complimentary plates of hummus, served with a corn and black bean salad, so we each accepted one and took seats on a bench. 20 years earlier, the most a place like this might have offered was fried okra. Now there was organic coffee and artisanal goat cheese. Above our heads hung a sign that read, Whispering Dove Ranch. And just as I thought that we might be anywhere, I noticed that the music piped through the speakers was Christian, the new kind, which says that Jesus is awesome. Hugh brought my father a plastic cup of water. You okay, Lou? Fine, my father answered. Why do you think she did it? I asked as we stepped back into the sunlight. For that's all any of us were thinking, had been thinking, since we got the news. Mustn't Tiffany have hoped that whatever pills she'd taken wouldn't be strong enough, and that her failed attempt would lead her back into our fold? How could anyone purposefully leave us, us of all people? This is how I thought of it, for though I've often lost faith in myself, I've never lost faith in my family, in my certainty that we are fundamentally better than everyone else. It's an archaic belief, one I haven't seriously reconsidered since my late teens, but still I hold it. Ours is the only club I'd ever wanted to be a member of, so I couldn't imagine quitting. Backing off for a year or two was understandable, but to want out so badly that you take your own life? I don't know that it had anything to do with us, my father said. But how could it have not? Doesn't the blood of every suicide splash back on our faces? At the far end of the parking lot was a stand selling reptiles. In giant tanks were two pythons, each as big around as a fire hose. The heat seemed to suit them, and I watched as they raised their heads, testing the screen ceilings. Beside the snakes was a low pen corralling an alligator with its mouth banded shut. It wasn't full grown, but perhaps an adolescent, around 3 feet long and grumpy looking. A girl had stuck her arm through the wire and was stroking the thing's back while it glared, seething. I'd like to buy everything here, just so I could kill it, I said. My father mopped his forehead with a Kleenex. I'm with you, brother. When we were young and would set off for the beach, I'd look out the window at all the landmarks we drove by, the Purina silo on the south side of Raleigh, the Klan billboard, knowing that when we passed them a week later, I'd be miserable. Our vacation over, now there'd be nothing to live for until Christmas. My life is much fuller than it was back then, yet this return felt no different. What time is it? I asked Amy. And instead of saying, who cares, she snapped, you tell me you're the one with the watch on. At the airport a few hours later, I picked sand from my pockets and thought of our final moments at the beach house I'd bought. I was on the front porch with Phyllis, who had just locked the door, and we turned to see the others in the driveway below us. So is that one of your sisters? She asked, pointing to Gretchen. It is, I said, and so are the two women standing on either side of her. Then you've got your brother, she observed. That makes five. Wow, now that's a big family. I looked at the sun-baked cars we would soon be climbing into, furnaces, every one of them, and said, yes, it certainly is. House divided. Because I'd accumulated so many miles, they bumped me to first class on the flight from Atlanta to Raleigh. I had assumed that our plane would be on the small side, but instead, owing to Thanksgiving and the great number of travelers, it was full size. I was seated in the second row, in front of a woman who looked to be in her early 60s and was letting her hair fade from dyed red to gray. After she settled in, she started a conversation with the fellow beside her. That's how I learned that she lived in Costa Rica. "It's on account of my husband," she said. "He's military, well, retired military, though you never really leave the Marine Corps, do you?" She started explaining what had taken her from North Carolina to Central America, but then the flight attendant came to take a drink order from the guy next to me, and I missed it. Just as I was tuning back in, a man across the aisle tried to open his overhead bin. It was stuck for some reason, and he pounded on it, saying to anyone who would listen, "This is like Obamacare, broken." Several of the passengers around me laughed, and I noted their faces, vowing that in the event of a crisis, I would not help lead them to an emergency exit. "You people are on your own," I thought, knowing that if anything bad did happen, it would likely be one of them who'd save me. It would be just my luck. I had passed judgment, so fate would force me to eat my words. After we took off from Atlanta, I pulled out my notebook, half making a list of things we'd need for Thanksgiving, and half listening to the woman behind me, who continued to talk throughout the entire flight. I guessed she was drinking, though I could have been wrong. Perhaps she was always this loud and adamant. "I never said I'd spend the rest of my life there. That's not what I meant at all." It was dark by the time we landed in Raleigh. And as we taxied to the gate, one of the flight attendants made an announcement. The "remain seated until the fasten seatbelt sign has been turned off" part was to be expected. But then she added that we had some very special passengers on board. "Oh, no," I thought. "Please don't embarrass me." I was just wondering who the other important person might be when she said, "With us today is the outstanding soccer team from..." She named a high school in the Triangle area and concluded with, "Let's give them all a great big hand." The woman behind me whooped and cheered. And when no one joined her, she raised her voice, shouting, "You people are assholes. I mean, what the hell? You can't even applaud for your own teenagers?" I meant to, but figured the team was back in coach. They wouldn't have heard me one way or the other, so what difference did it make? "Pathetic," the woman spat. "Too wrapped up in your smartphones and iPads to congratulate a group of high school athletes." You couldn't say she hadn't nailed us. Still, I had to bite my hand to keep from laughing. It's so funny to be called an asshole by someone who doesn't know you, but then again, knows you so perfectly. "See that woman?" I said to Hugh when he met me at the baggage claim a few minutes later. I told him what had happened on the plane, and he folded his arms across his chest the way he always does before lecturing me. "She was right, you know. You should have applauded." "We've been apart for 2 months," I reminded him. "Would it kill you to take my side in this?" He apologized, but after I'd wrestled my bag off the carousel and we'd started toward the parking lot, he added, quietly, but not so quietly that I couldn't hear him, "You really should have clapped." From the airport, we drove to my brother Paul's. There we met up with my sister Gretchen, who had a cast on her right forearm and held it aloft like someone perpetually being sworn in. "It helps ease the pain," she explained. I hadn't seen Gretchen since the previous spring and was startled by her appearance. For as long as I could remember, she'd worn her hair long, and though it still fell to below her shoulder blades in the back, the top was now cropped and stood from the crown of her head like the fur of a graying German shepherd. Odder still, she had a sun visor on. "Since when have you had this mullet?" I asked. Only when she lifted it off did I realize she was wearing a cap, the sort sold in joke shops. "The hair is attached to the top of it, see? I got it at the beach last month." I hadn't been to our house on Emerald Isle, the C-section, since we'd bought it 5 months earlier, though Hugh had. He'd flown over in late September to start making improvements. Gretchen joined him for a few days shortly before Halloween and fell into a rut while walking on the beach. That's how she broke her arm. "Can you believe it?" she asked. "No one has worse luck than me." When there's no traffic, it's a 2.5-hour drive from Raleigh to Emerald Isle. We left at around 8 p.m., and on the way, I asked Gretchen about her job. She works as a horticulturalist for the city of Raleigh and had recently discovered a campsite in one of its larger parks. That's common enough, but this one was occupied by someone we once knew. His name was familiar, but I couldn't picture his face until Gretchen put him in context. He used to come over to the house and hang out with Mom. "Oh, right," I said. Kids like to believe that their parents will get lonely after they leave the house, but I think my mother actually did. She delighted in her children and always enjoyed talking to our friends and the people we were going out with. "Why don't you invite Jeff to dinner?" I remember her asking Gretchen one night in the late 70s. Because we broke up a month ago and I've been in my room crying ever since. "Well, he still needs to eat," my mother said. The fellow who wound up living in a city park, Kevin, I'll call him, started dropping by in the early 80s. His parents and mine owned some rental property together, and over the years, both he and I performed odd jobs there. I remembered him as directionless and guessed from what my sister told me that he pretty much stayed that way. Still, it seemed incredible to me that something like this could happen, for we were middle class, and I'd been raised to believe that our social status inoculated us against severe misfortune. A person might be broke from time to time who wasn't. But you could never be poor the way that actual poor people were. Poor with lice and missing teeth. Your genes would reject it. Slip too far beneath the surface, and wouldn't your family resuscitate you with a loan or rehab or whatever it was you needed to get back on your feet? Then there'd be friends, hopefully ones who went to college and might at the very least view you as a project, the thing they'd renovate after the kitchen was finished. At what point had I realized that class couldn't save you, that addiction or mental illness didn't care whether you'd taken piano lessons or spent a summer in Europe? Which drunk or junkie or unmedicated schizophrenic was I crossing the street to avoid when I put it all together? I didn't know what the story was with Kevin. The two of us had had every advantage, yet now he was living in a thicket 3 miles from the house he grew up in. My siblings and I used to worry that once our father was gone, a similar fate might befall our sister Tiffany, who had committed suicide 6 months earlier. Like all of us, she received an inheritance a few years after our mother died. It wasn't a fortune, but it was certainly more than I had ever seen. The money arrived just after I really needed it, at a moment when, for the first time in my adult life, I was finally on my feet. I paid off my student loan with a portion of it. My father wanted me to invest the rest, but I didn't want the idea of money. I wanted the real thing. So I parked it in my checking account and would go to an ATM sometimes twice a day just to look at my balance on the screen. A year earlier, the most I'd had was $100. Now, this. It was interesting to see what we all did with our inheritance. Pragmatic Lisa put her check in the bank. Gretchen moved south and saw to some bills, while Amy and Paul essentially spent their money on candy. Tiffany was the only one who quit her job, thinking, I guess, that she was set. Within 2 years, she was broke, but rather than rejoining the workforce, she decided that money was evil, as were most of the people who had it. She canceled her checking account and started bartering, exchanging a day's work for a carton of cigarettes or a bag of groceries. At night, she'd go through people's trash cans, looking for things she could sell. It's like she saw poverty as an accomplishment. I'll be out at 1 in the morning, knee-deep in a dumpster, and elbowing aside some immigrant Haitian lady for the good stuff, she boasted once when I visited her in Somerville. Maybe the Haitian woman has to be there, I said. She has nothing at her disposal while you have an education. You had braces on your teeth. You speak good English. My argument was an old and stodgy one. The best thing you can do for the poor is avoid joining their ranks, thus competing with them for limited goods and services. On that same visit, Tiffany explained that poor people refuse to answer surveys. When census takers come to our doors, we ignore them. She spoke the way a tribal leader might to a visiting anthropologist. We Pawnees grind our corn with a rock. Every time I visited, her apartment was more of a wreck. Not just messy, but filthy. How can you live like this? I asked the last time I was there. We poor people don't have the energy to clean up after ourselves, she told me. After she was evicted, she lived in a series of single rooms with people just as badly off as herself. According to Tiffany, the only thing wrong with her was her back. That's why, at the age of 43, she went on disability, she said. Since when, though, do they prescribe lithium and Klonopin for back pain? If she'd been more forthright, we could have put her behavior in context, could have said, when she tested our patients, that's her illness talking. As it was, it didn't add up. Why can't a grown woman hold a job, we wondered. Why does she have so many restraining orders against people? Tiffany would have inherited money from our father someday, though she likely would have burned right through it. You want a car? She'd have said, perhaps to someone she met in a parking lot. I'll buy you a fucking Bronco or whatever. Is that what you want? Word would have gotten out that some lady was buying people Broncos, and in no time she'd have been penniless again and feeling just fine about it. An hour before arriving at the beach, Hugh stopped at a fast food place called Hardee's so I could get a coffee. The town we were in was small and grim, and the restaurant was deserted except for us. Inside the front door stood a Christmas tree, over-decorated in a majestic combination of red and gold. How long has this been up? I asked the woman behind the counter. She scratched at the tattoos on her left forearm, initials that looked like they'd been done at home with a sewing needle. Since last Tuesday, maybe? She turned to the fellow cleaning the grill. Does that sound right? Just about, he said. Will you have a tree at home? I asked. Have you put it up yet? This is the sort of thing that drives Hugh crazy. What does it matter if her Christmas tree is up? But there was no one in line behind me, and I was genuinely curious. I think it's too early, the woman said. My kids is all excited for one, but we ain't even had Thanksgiving yet. Gretchen ran her good hand over the false hair on top of her head. Will you cook a turkey on Thanksgiving or go with something else? Are you too happy now? Hugh asked when we finally returned to the car. Need to go back in and learn what everyone's doing for New Year's, or do you think we can leave? Gretchen propped up her broken arm on the narrow window ledge. If he thinks we're bad, he should spend more time with Lisa. That's true, I agreed. Lisa's the master. I left her at a Starbucks for 90 seconds last year, and when I returned, the woman behind the counter was saying to her, "My gynecologist told me that exact same thing." I normally don't believe in drinking coffee in the car. Most often I spill more than I swallow. But without it, I'd have fallen asleep and then had to revive myself once we reached the house. It was after 11 when we arrived, and I was pleasantly surprised by all the changes. The place we bought is 2 stories tall and divided down the middle into equal-sized units. You can pass back and forth between one half and the other by way of a hotel-style connecting door in the living room, but it's inconvenient if you're upstairs. The 2 kitchens are another problem, as we really only need one. Our initial idea was to knock down some walls and transform it into a single 6-bedroom home. Then I recalled our last trip to the beach and the number of times I found my brother lying on the sofa with his shoes on, and decided that 2 separate halves was probably a good idea. The left side, which was softly lit and decorated with carefully chosen mid-century furniture, was mine and Hugh's, while the junky right side was for everyone else. Of course, other people could stay in our half, but only when we were there to monitor and scold them. Because everyone was coming for Thanksgiving, the house was going to be full. The family was arriving in dribs and drabs, so for the first night, it was just the 3 of us. On the 2nd day, late in the afternoon, Lisa pulled up. I helped her unload her car, and then we took a walk on the beach. It was cold enough to see our breath, and a strong wind was blowing. "Did I tell you I got Tiffany's toxicology report?" she asked a while after we'd left the house. "They also sent me her death certificate, and apparently..." At that moment, a Labrador retriever bounded up, tail wagging, a middle-aged woman in a baseball cap trotting behind it. "Brandy, no," she scolded, adding as she unfurled her leash, "I'm sorry."
For what? Lisa gathered the dog's head in her hand. You're beautiful, aren't you? She trilled in the melodic voice she uses for things with tails. Yes, you are, and you know it. She turned to the owner. How old is she? 2 years this February, the woman said. I have one that age, Lisa told her, and she's a real handful. I have no patience for this kind of talk, and turned to face the ocean, waiting for the conversation to end. Hopefully then I could learn what our sister had used to kill herself with. We figured she had taken pills, clonopin, most likely. And though it technically didn't matter if she'd mixed it with other things, we still wanted to know. Behind me, Lisa was telling the strange woman that the Newfoundland water dog she had before the one she has now died after swallowing all her husband Bob's high blood pressure medication. My God, the woman said, that must have been awful. Oh, it was, Lisa told her. We just felt so guilty. The woman with the Labrador wished us